Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. John C. Havens is Executive Director of the IEEE Global Initiative on Ethics of Autonomous and Intelligent Systems that has two primary outputs: the creation and iteration of body of work known as Ethically Aligned Design, a vision for prioritizing human well-being with autonomous and intelligent systems, and the recommendation of ideas for standards projects focused on prioritizing ethical considerations in A/IS. Currently, there are 15 approved standards working groups in the IEEE P7000 series. He is also executive director for the Council on Extended Intelligence, CXI, that was created to proliferate the ideals of responsible participant design, data agency, and metrics of economic prosperity, prioritizing people and the planet over profit and productivity. CXI is a program founded by the IEEE Standards Association and MIT, whose members include representatives from the EU Parliament, the UK House of Lords, and dozens of global policy, academic, and business leaders. Previously, John was an EVP of social media at PR firm Porter Novelli and professional actor for over 15 years. John has written for Mashable and The Guardian and is author of the books Artificial Intelligence, Embracing Our Humanity to Maximize Machines, and Hacking Happiness: Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World. With you now, our host for this podcast, Kelly Forbes.
Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I think a good place for us to start is with a phrase: I think, therefore I am. Can you tell us a little bit more about this idea, and has any of your ideas changed in recent years since your TED Talk in 2013?
Well, first of all, thank you for watching it. Always appreciated. And yeah, the famous Kant saying, I think, therefore I am. I thought it was fun to use the phrase, I think, therefore I am, like I talked about in the TED Talk. The logic being that any time we use social media or even send an email, or even when we're on Zoom, like we are right now recording this podcast, aspects of our data are being shared. And so sync is a broad term for sort of any time that our identity via our data is shared with others. And yeah, certainly the past 7 or 8 years, a lot has happened in the data realm. And I can certainly expand on that if you'd like.
Yes, I think that would be great, especially considering, you know, the whole latest conversation we have in the big tech companies, you know, involving Apple, Facebook this week, actually. I'm sure there's a lot more you can cover as well in the last few years. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, first of all, the GDPR came out. So that was transformational. At my TED Talk, you know, that amazing legislation. And now with my work in IEEE, which I can tell you more about in a moment. And by the way, I'm speaking here as John, not as a formal representative of IEEE for the call, for the interview rather. Anyway, the GDPR was, you know, as you know, this landmark legislation that, especially from a European perspective, meaning how to, you know, human dignity and human rights, how to protect individuals' data, was just transformative. And I still remember when I first read about GDPR, I stood up in my living room and screamed in happiness. So it was a happy yell. Just because I thought this is a benchmark. This will be a way for people to understand how precious their data is. You know, like any legislation, it's now one of those things where a lot of times now people click the new kind of terms and regulations around GDPR, not fully understanding all of what it entails, but still it's there. Privacy by design, that amazing technique and methodology that started largely in Canada, has also become a big deal. The California Data Privacy Act, I think I have that right. I get the initials wrong sometimes. A big deal. And certainly a lot of my work, and a couple of books ago, I wrote a book called Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Will Change the World. The whole idea of sovereign data, which it's a big umbrella term I use, but basically means when you can have personal data stores, or like what we're doing a lot of in IEEE, different people are calling things like pods. It just means the same way that you can store your data on your computer and share it, at least that's the idea, that you could share it with just one trusted person through an encrypted manner. That's the same logic for everything that we should be doing moving forward. You and I should both have our own individual ways to share our data in kind of a blockchain way. So now there's a wonderful opportunity for that to happen, because also a lot of the big tech companies are facing, for good reason, the need to not just better protect people's data, but to recognize that it is too precious a resource just to, be sold in a marketplace where people don't have access to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how does that all, is aligned to AI? And what are the main challenges you're seeing there in the industry?
Sure. No, that's a great question. I mean, I think people, tend to, first of all, lump AI into, they think it's one big technology, where it's like talking about the internet, right? It's dozens of different protocols and different tools. Artificial intelligence can be everything from kind of simple machine learning to AGI to reinforcement learning, and a lot of times all the stuff in between. The thing that makes it unique, while not every system or every algorithm tracks human data, sometimes it's machine, city work or something, still in general, I don't know, what's the percentage? 90% of most AI at some point or another tracks and utilizes human data. And the other part of that process is it goes to the cloud. And even when I spoke in 2013, the cloud existed, of course, but not nearly as savvy or advanced as it is now. And that's really tricky, because especially from a legal standpoint, where servers exist, there's all these legal distinctions. There was a big thing about servers in Ireland and there being issues with Facebook data, and that's the physical manifestation of the data, but the cloud itself is obviously all around us and above us or whatever. And that's the thing about AI that is so different from what's been before, is it's so vast and not all, but pretty much B2B, B2C companies use AI internally. And then more and more every product or service has some element of an algorithm within it. And because all of that incorporates, or most of it incorporates, human data and goes to the cloud, it becomes really, really critically important that people understand why their data is so precious and why they have to protect it.
Yeah. So Apple has provided us with a speech this week, which I was actually busy watching last night. And it's quite a profound speech in terms of how it guides us in how companies should be administering people's data. Do you agree with that position in terms of advertisement? The advertisement industry might be affected. How do we move from where we are now to where we need to go?
Yeah, the short answer is I haven't read the whole speech, but I read portions of it, and it's, just agreed.
It's a great speech, I found. I don't know if you agree with me, but yeah.
Yeah, no, 1,000%. In the sense of, people tend to forget, Google is an advertising company. Alphabet is different. They've got a wide array of companies. And this does not mean that Google is evil, right? In my last book, Artificial Intelligence, I focused an entire chapter on that whole idea of do no evil. And most people don't go beyond that phrase. They talk about that phrase, do no evil, and they make it about morality. Where if you really read what the Google folks wrote, which I love, is they talked about short-termism versus long-termism. And they said their focus was not going to be on short-termism. And short-termism means prioritizing things like exponential growth, speed to market, or exponential shareholder growth. And I use the term exponential. It's a very important term because growth and profit, right, in terms of like, why are those things bad? Well, they aren't bad. It's more that it's about what you prioritize, when you prioritize it, and then what else do you prioritize or choose to ignore? And if through rushing to market or prioritizing, say, an ever-increasing amount of money going to shareholders, then what you actually do is limit things like how much R&D a company can have. If the company is really focused on, we have to make this much more this quarter to get to our shareholders. And there's this irony because a lot of times in the work I'm in ethics, you'll hear people say things like, don't hinder innovation. And I point out that the way that kind of shareholder models exist today, that hinders innovation much more than things like responsible design for AI. And that's why there's this wonderful opportunity. And I think also solution, there's a logic called the triple bottom line, which I'm sure you've heard of. It's the basic idea is people, planet, and profit. So the three P's. And I mentioned timing. The logic is at the outset, the very beginning of design, when you are building technology, certainly AI, there's this opportunity, and I believe a mandate to say, how is what we're building going to not just keep from harming the environment and people's well-being, but how can we make sure, you know, 33% for each of these things, that the key performance indicators for all three of these things are things we prioritize. Now, what that means is instead of saying producing a piece of technology, and I've worked with a lot of companies, I get it. You put $1 million into a prototype. It's a much different conversation when you've put that year of resources into a, you know, piece of technology or multiple millions. And then you're saying, well, let's do our best to make this as ethical as we can or risk-free or what have you, which are important discussions to have. But there's so many constraints and limitations and then the urgency to get to market. It's not that I'm saying or implying people are gonna, you know, not do things to keep it safe, but it's a very different set of key performance indicators and measures of success in that scenario versus saying at the beginning, while you're still on the design stage, how is what we're building going to increase environmental flourishing, increase human well-being, where the profits in one sense, at least for a while, if we want to kind of keep our planet and people where they are now, or, you know, not even where they are now because we're suffering so much with COVID, these are priorities that we have to set. And in terms of Apple and the industry, I know this is a longer answer probably, but the economic system, but this kind of fits what I've just said. If the economics always come first, right? And people may say, well, you have to have the economics come first. The answer is, yes, you don't. What if every conversation for policy started with this conversation about our business is about how we're going to not just help the environment with normal CSR or ESG reporting, but we are fundamentally going to make our business about every aspect of, say, our supply chain, help the environment. And by the way, this is not to be negative towards Apple in any way, but, you know, it's, I love what Tim Cook said about the data stuff. My request to urgency or opportunity for Apple is to say, you know, your supply chain and how the environment is being handled with all aspects of hardware and software that Apple creates. And this is not, again, to in any way be negative, but more to say, I don't need a phone every year. I like them. They're beautiful, but I don't need a phone every year. Yeah. And triple bottom line is as much about you and me as customers as it is about the companies. Anyway, long answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if it's the same design every year, in a way, yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But going back to, I like your point about the perspective about, the work in ethics can hinder innovation. And I've heard that in different contexts as well, in the same way that we hear about that, you know, we don't have any control of our data. We need to embrace technology and it's just the way it is. And I would probably say also to your point that, you know, nothing can hinder innovation as much as lack of trust. If you do not trust someone, if you do not trust an organization, it's very unlikely you want to do business with them. So, and I feel like that's the foundation for everything that we are doing here with technology.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, and again, from a very positive standpoint, my day job, and I'll cover this now, I work with a wonderful organization called IEEE, or it's I with three E's. And it's the world's largest professional technology association, and it largely serves engineers and academics. It's been around for almost 100 years. It was founded by Thomas Edison. And the reason I was so glad to begin first as a consultant and now on staff is their tagline, which is advancing technology for humanity. And the work that I've had the honor to help drive for about almost 6 years now is running a program focused on AI and ethics. And we've created a document called Ethically Aligned Design, which about 700 people helped create. We had 500 pages of feedback for it. We had three different versions over about 4 years. And the first version, you know, there's about, what, 125 different sets of AI principles. The first one, that the first version we launched in 2016 was used by the OECD, UNICEF, IBM, dozens of organizations, which the Future of Life Institute principles. And so it's really exciting because, you know, we were foundational in supporting a lot of the community, which is really exciting. A number of standards came from that work that were also, you know, very much focused on the same idea of prioritizing values-driven design at the outset of design.
Yeah, let's dive a little bit more into this work. So what are the, you know, what are the main challenges there that you found along the way? So from what I understand, the IEEE program is, you know, is a program that ensures every technologist is educated, trained, and empowered to prioritize ethical considerations in the design and development of autonomous and intelligent systems. Is that right? That's the main foundation behind that work, I guess.
Yep, no, thank you. That's the vision statement for, the full name is the IEEE Global Initiative on Ethics of Autonomous and Intelligent Systems. And the sort of summation of what you said is really kind of redesigning engineering from the inside out. And if that's not wildly arrogant, it's intended to be supportive, meaning I'm not an engineer. But I've learned in the past 5 or 6 years how deeply I respect engineers. I mean, we get in an elevator, and I never thought like, hey, I hope this elevator works. You know, you get in the elevator, right? That's because engineers made it safe. And so it took me a while too, and we found this internally at IEEE. It's a very big organization. It's in 160 countries and over 1 million members and stuff. And so. It was easy to sort of be the happy ethics guy and like, this is great stuff. You should try it out. And engineers understandably were like, yeah, we're familiar with the ethics stuff, my friend. We've been building bridges. And so a lot of what was so exciting, I mentioned all the different people working on the paper, really a lot of the learning came from cross-pollination. And this is where I think now, and what we call, or what is known as participant design, you know, is where you can get end users involved in anything you're creating and where you have diversity. Diversity is key. So especially if you create principles with only data scientists or only engineers or only academics or even those three groups, and you don't bring in sociologists, lawyers, human rights experts, therapists, especially we have a whole chapter on effective computing. And it just simply doesn't make sense to not have experts in human emotion and affect when you are talking about effective sensors, for instance. And then we got really lucky after our first version. I mentioned the feedback that we got. A lot of the feedback came from IEEE members and colleagues in China and Japan, Singapore, and South Korea. And it was so exciting for me because a lot of the feedback also said, hey, this is great work, but it's very Western. You should get some more Eastern voices. And so we added the chapter called Classical Ethics in AI, which I love that chapter. I'm very proud of it. I mean, I didn't write it, but I'm very proud it's in there, because that also brings the perspective, you know, to honor the AI Asia Pacific logic, you know, of who are, you know, the entire idea of things like non-dualism, you know, issues sometimes people have with Western, not necessarily issues, but recognizing that Western democracy is a certain framing of how to think, and that cultural underpinning of thought obviously then really frames every aspect of design. You know, bias is not necessarily just about negative things, you know, avoiding sexism or racism. Bias is also the perspective that we bring to any of the things that we do, and recognizing that someone is from a culture in the East or the global South, or that someone's a woman or a person of color or a man. These are just things that when you build stuff, those things have to factor into what you build, or you likely, you know, you might offend someone, right? Or you might, the sort of least kind of moral oriented thing is they won't buy your stuff, because the message is essentially, you didn't take the time to ask me what I think about using this. And then to your point about trust, a lot of trust is about communication. And a lot of trust is just saying to someone, what do you think? And if the message is like, well, I'm getting this to market because we did some research and I know that you're going to like this, right? You might get lucky. And that's, you know, Apple, of course, lives by the design, beautiful design thing and all that. But that's different than, you know, design in that sense is different than, are you creating something with an algorithm that could mean, because of a marginalized group, they may not have access to medical care or something. So it's a very different aspect of trust. It's not just trust that we keep someone from buying your stuff. It's trust that we keep someone from being safe or healthy.
Yeah. I think going back to your point there about, you know, understanding engineers and people that do, you know, this type of work and the challenges that they have, it's such an important part of this work. And you quickly realize it coming, you know, from the ethical legal perspective, that it's not black and white. It's actually quite challenging to follow and understand this ethical guidelines, right? And it is something that takes you out of your comfort zone. It's not necessarily an easy path.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think if this helps, one thing I've learned is, understandably, companies especially, I think they hear the word ethics and they instantly, which I think is fair, it's not a pleasant conversation. It's not like, yay, we're going to talk about ethics. Yay, circle the wagons, grab a coffee. It's usually like, I used to work in PR. So there's the question of, is someone going to say that we're bad, right? That's ethics to a lot of people is about morality. Applied ethics, however, is about design. And that's what we're really focused on, right? Applied ethics are all these methodologies. Some are called values-based design. We have a big standard working group. It's called IEEE P as in Peter 7000, about systems design, where the way that traditional systems design is done on the front end of that process, you use what's essentially called values-sensitive design, which is really just a lot of methodologies about saying who is going to use this technology and how do we understand them. So a simple example that I give, which doesn't by any means give full credit to the work being done by that working group, but is, say you were building a phone and for some reason you wanted it to appeal to moms. Now, I don't know why you would, but let's say you were, right? The privacy settings, say there were, you know, 3 or 7 privacy settings you could create, and you did a lot of market research with moms in the region you're selling the phone to, and they delineated those 7 different areas of privacy. Then when you sold your phone, and I would recommend you should, you market a lot of it on, you are the phone that has more privacy options based on what moms want than anyone else. Now that's a more marketing oriented example, but the logic there is, from a values standpoint, those moms have said, these are my values. And if you only have three settings for privacy, then what that means is a mom might buy your phone, but then she's probably going to have to use a setting that isn't actually what she wants. Those seven, right? There's this chance for real trust. So all that is to say, it's a methodology, right? The same way that Agile for marketing is a methodology. It's not about saying, here is the moral answer. It's about saying, it's a technique, right? Asking the end user much more thoroughly about their values. Now, it doesn't mean you pander to them, right? Our ethically aligned design, the first voted by all the people who worked on it, the first principle is human rights. So human rights first, and there's in the business world something called the Ruggie principles, which is how you can use human rights in a business setting, also like a methodology. But the logic is, okay, when something you know is in general not going to cause harm from a human rights standpoint, then what is it they want, right? And the thing is, it's so fascinating to me is people like, that's really hard. And I'm like, the entire economic underpinnings of algorithmic tracking, you know, everyone knows what you and I ate 20 minutes ago and where we walked in GPS. And I'm talking to you right now and my voice and Neuralink is going to be able to read our brain soon, right? So I'm like, all that happens and companies can't institute some methodologies, by the way, to have a new form of R&D and to also recognize that to have trust in the algorithmic age, you need to let the people in and let them give an opportunity to speak back to you. Again, using these sovereign data tools, like I mentioned before. So for us, it's all really exciting and very positive in the sense of ethics is not, you know, only about, you know, discussing aspects of what's right or wrong, as it were, or what's responsible mean. It's this wonderful opportunity for design, but it can't happen without participant design, without recognizing that trust really means letting people into the design process.
Yeah. And in terms of what the future holds in respect of, you know, all this intersection, the future of AI as humans, what is your opinion on that? Do you think that we are moving forward into a brighter future, given, you know, the latest news, the GDPR and so on? Or are you still very much concerned about where this is all going?
On a personal level, and again, I'm speaking for John, as John at IEEE, as a rule, I'm skeptical and pretty concerned. And this is, again, not anyone's fault per se, but we're living in the COVID era, you know, and it's fascinating to me that so many people talk about business as usual. And I'm like, why? Business as usual is one of the reasons we got here, you know, like, The GDP, I mentioned metrics of success, the GDP, which is the main, you know, set of metrics around finances that most countries and businesses use as a way of saying, are we successful? But it was never built to measure caregiving. There are no formal metrics about caregiving. So that means for the past 60 or 70 years, caregiving, by and large, goes ignored in the sense of what's prioritized every quarter. Will we hit our numbers? Those are the five words. That means the numbers are finances first. And you know, people say, well, of course, if we don't have finances first, then our business won't survive. But where we are now is when people and the planet are not prioritized, we are facing a genuine, as far as I know from the science, our planet in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever it is, may not be here. And my kids will still be alive. I want my kids to live on a flourishing planet. So it's not that I want to sound negative to any particular company or government. It's more about, does someone have a solution that's working? And so far the answer, as far as I can tell, is no. And a lot of it is clinging to these systems, largely about, frankly, inequality. And this is some of my favorite economists, Joseph Stiglitz, Mariana Mazzucato out of Italy, Kate Raworth with a wonderful book called Donut Economics. It's I think pretty empirical when there's what, like 80 people that own like 60% of the world's wealth. And then most of the systems around those people, including things like tax evasion. And that's one thing about Apple sometimes that's it's tough for me because I have so much respect for Tim Cook on the privacy stuff, but for all big companies, I don't understand why people don't pay corporate taxes. I mean, I understand they don't want to lose the money, but I pay taxes. Yeah. You probably pay taxes. And also I feel like I don't want to be angry about it, but like if everyone knows the corporate taxes are there and companies aren't paying them, and it means that there's billions, if not trillions of dollars that aren't going back into the system. That's where I also feel like, well, can we make new laws and just say, hey, we know you're just going to break those laws, so let's make different laws, or maybe let's not tax you as high. So that's where people who are smarter than me can come in and talk about incentives, et cetera. But for me, I just get very frustrated because I'm like, why are we working so hard to give incentives to either people or companies where aspects of those systems, not necessarily individual people are evil and all that, but those systems, again, are why we're here. And more importantly, what are we going to do in like 40 or 50 years? I think about this all the time. Is someone going to say like, I'm really glad we didn't pressure X company. I'm really glad we didn't get awkward on phone calls about whatever with shareholders. Even though, and sorry to be morbid, my kids right now are suffering and don't have access to water. I mean, I think about Johannesburg running out of water almost like 3 years ago. I think about the fact that water is now being traded on markets. And think of what happened with GameStop last week, right? Bunch of people on Reddit, which I love, by the way, they gamed the system. And then a lot of the Wall Street people got mad. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I was enraged. I'm like, that is the system you set up. You control the system, and then people got upset. Oh, they can't do that. And I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, I love, what's her name? Alexandra AOC, you know, wonderful politician whose work I admire so much. And she's like, are you kidding? So people who have not as much money to trade, but they trade, make a lot of money, and then you get upset. But that's everything. Like, I think I never forget about that ever since 2008 in the States with the whole mortgage crisis. I still have friends who are suffering very, very much because of their loss of savings. And the banks got saved. Okay. But now I read last year about XNX Bank making more money than they ever have in the year of COVID. And on a personal level, it's very hard to read that because then I want to say like, cool. You know what you could do, ma'am? You could give that money back. And then it's like, people are like, ha ha ha. And I'm like, what? Wait, hold on. People broke the law in 2008, right? From my understanding, if you watch the movie, The Big Short, for instance, you can see it's all fact. Yeah. And people premeditatively lied. So, okay. And then you got bailed out and the CEOs still make an absurd amount of money. And then people aren't like, okay, so now you're making all that money back in the year of COVID, where so many people have lost their jobs. What a wonderful, and I'm going to try not to be angry, like what an awesome opportunity for a bunch of banks to be like, you know what, here's a couple billion dollars. And you know what, we don't need a tax break. We're just giving that money for vaccinations, because you want to know how to really earn my trust? Banks, there you go. Give the money back, man, that my taxes paid for.
I was going to say that if anything, COVID has really brought a lot of these issues into light, right? The inequality, people are still having advantage over others despite the current situation.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, rather than be angry, I would love to have whoever in the room and say, you know, is there a logic that maybe you think you'll get on like a spaceship to Mars, you know, like how many people fit? Is it like 200, you know, or that something's going to change and all of a sudden, like, do you just not believe the science of the climate stuff? Let's have that conversation and really dig into what that means. And then for kids and COVID and caregiving and mental health, it's, you know, solving it with, I don't know, robots or drugs. There's some solutions that could be very useful and helpful with robot care assistance, for instance, and pharmaceuticals. So I'm not trying to sound negative to those things per se, but they aren't the only things. We as humans are built to give care to one another. And if we're facilitated to do that, and that's prioritized, then that's where along with these beautiful technologies and pharmaceuticals or whatever, we can already help ourselves and others and can sustain, you know, human well-being. Versus, and this was my last two books talk a lot about this, automatically sort of saying, well, technology will take care of it, you know, techno-utopianism, because it won't. It isn't right now. And it's also not technology's, in my opinion, responsibility. It's society's. You and me as individuals and society as groups is to say, how do we care for one another? How do we care for our future children? And this is where a lot of the indigenous thought leaders that are doing such amazing work in the AI space, such an opportunity to think about this idea of 7 or 8 or more generations beyond us. If we're always thinking about for our business, for our lives, how is not just my next, you know, my kids or my grandkids, for the next 7 generations, how do we think about, protect for, and sustain the environment and each other?
Yeah, a long way to go. Thank you, John, for taking the time to have this conversation today.
Yeah, thanks for letting me soapbox. It was really fun to talk to you.
So people are trying to find you. So can you just let us know where can we find your books? Where can people get in touch with you?
Sure. So the work I lead at IEEE, there's a website called Ethics in Action. So those words are all together, ethicsinaction.ieee.org. And then I'm on Twitter and I use my middle initial. So it's J-O-H-N-C, as in Charles, H-A-V-E-N-S, John C. Havens on Twitter. And then my last book is called Heartificial Intelligence, Embracing Our Humanity to Maximize Machines. And that is on Amazon, and my other books you can find there as well.
Excellent. Thank you again.
Thank you.